I guess we can start, and everyone who is coming is present, hopefully. This is actually the second to last lecture of this course, so we are almost done with the lectures. Hopefully, we are almost done with the rest of the work, but there's still plenty of time to complete that. Now, today, we are going to talk about input and output, which is a bit of a strange topic because in any other programming course, this is the stuff that you start with. The first thing you do is you print "Hello World," then you read, console input from the user, then you greet the user. You do all kinds of file reading and, input-output type stuff. Except in Haskell, this needs to be at the end of the course because of the types. We have to be able to read the types regarding I/O to make use of that thing here. So we spend this entire lecture talking about how I/O works in Haskell. I/O means input and output, or interaction with the real world. Before we start, I made this workload survey that I talked with you last time, and I got a few more answers. Still way too few to make any kind of conclusions. There's 150 people are registered to this course, and something like 28 people answered the survey. So I have no reasonable sample to make any kind of deductions whether this is too hard or not. Seems to be, based on these numbers, it's not going at least that badly wrong. Mostly thought it's, a bit stiff. Oh yeah, it's a programming course. It's supposed to be a bit stiff. It's not working correctly if it's not a bit stiff. Some people thought it okay. One protest vote said that it's too easy. I'm pretty sure it's not too easy. And about six people said it's too much work. Can't manage with that amount of work. Well, can't really do that much about it, at least in this course. I did drop the last exercise of the course, which was a large exercise, and, having a big exercise at the very end might be demotivating. So now it's an optional exercise, so I just, tip my hat towards you if you complete it, but it's not mandatory. So that's, I guess, this story. I think, maybe there is still one thing that should be done. Because many people who said that it's too hard or too time-consuming also said that some of the exercises are not clear. That is the reason why it's too hard, because some of the exercises are not clear enough. And, well, if I check the stars that you press when you complete an exercise in the web exercises, I get a distribution like this, which says that, vast majority of the, web exercises are, extremely clear. About half of that is four stars for clarity, so quite clear. And very few people have ranked any exercises as, unclear or two or one. And those exercises that are ranked, one, I can't really understand what is going on here, were like "Hello World." That's very unclear. That's the second most unclear exercise in the course. URL parser is, very confusing. And counting empty lines in a string, very unclear exercises. And help me see why. I really can't figure out why these in special would be in this unclear section here. So I made another survey. This is probably something that most easily saves time for you. Just fill out this survey. Just, click on that. You have to have seen some exercise that was very unclear. Just click on that, tell me which exercise and why it was unclear. Probably won't help you during this course, but next year it will be easier for the next guys or people who are taking the course. I mean, if you said that "Hello World" is very confusing, please tell me why, because I'm so stupid that I can't actually figure out how to make it clearer. And obviously, it's not clear because people, say it's not clear, but I can't see why. During this lecture, yeah, you can just go and mark a few exercises difficult if you like. Also, it asks you why it was and how it should be worded if it was unclear. But okay, that's about this workload thing, I guess, unless there's any questions or comments. That's a good place to leave the comments. So, on to the topic. It's I/O. And when we do I/O in a functional language, especially in functional language with laziness, we have this inherent problem, meaning which of these could be functions? Not necessarily are, but which of these could be implemented as functions? First, removing consecutive duplicates from lists, like this other exercise, reading contents of a file to a string, probably manipulating it, sorting a list, like the merge sort exercise, extracting the current date when the program is run, or fetching a web page. You know, which of these are functions? Which could be implemented as functions? And by function, I mean function as in Haskell or function in this mathematical sense, not in C-sharp sense. Okay, we have 20 answers, so we can probably continue. You have at least, I think, thought about it. Okay, 30 answers, now it's definitely enough. Okay, so what's the status? Okay, these two, of course they are functions because we actually implemented them and we used functions to implement those two. So yes. If you just edit a list, return a copy of that list, it's a function. Same with sorting a list, return a sorted copy. No problem. About these three. Is it necessary to make a group discussion? Would you benefit? Because I'm afraid that this will end up in very boring group discussion. There's one group of five people who got this wrong, for example. So let's skip the group part. Why is a read contents of file? What makes this not a function? It's not a function. Well, the defining characteristic of functions in mathematics and in Haskell is that if you give the function the same input, it will return the same output. For this input, this output always. And a read file function, it would probably be something like you give it a file name and it will return you a string of the file contents. Does it always return the same string for the same file name? Well, obviously not, because you can change the file name. You can even remove the file entirely and call the function again, it won't return anything. So reading contents of a file, it can't be a function. Getting the current date, well, obviously if you call this function twice, well, it probably doesn't take any arguments, so it should be a constant value. But it's of course not a constant value because it changes every second or with a greater rate. So it's not a mathematical function. Web page. Same as reading a file, it doesn't really matter if it's online or not. Web pages are just files on a different computer and that's it. Or, you know, old web pages are that. So there's at least three things that we can't do with Haskell or Haskell functions. They're not basic run-of-the-mill mathematical functions, not enough. We can't, for example, fetch web pages, so we can't implement a web browser using a Haskell language. We can't actually make a program that reads a file if the only thing that we have is functions. So we must have something else. The usual choice made by almost all languages is that, let's skip the exactness and mathematics and make some other rules so functions can have side effects. let's skip the fact that function must return the same value for the same input and allow it to do something else. This is what you have in Java, C#, C, Swift. Any language with mutable values basically does this approach. Some almost pure languages like ML also have that approach. But in Haskell, based on what we have already learned, suppose that we would write code like this. Assume that person is constructor for some person data type. And we have this let clause. First name is something that you get from reading a line from the user. Last name, you read a line. And then you construct this person, first name, last name. Then you make another variable called e, which basically extracts the first name from this person that we created here. Now, Haskell is, for example, a lazy language. So how many lines are read on when we evaluate E? Two lines. Hands up if you think it's two lines. Or would be reasonable. Maybe. One line. Maybe. No, not really. This doesn't work. It's not valid Haskell code, so it doesn't do anything. But Haskell is a lazy language, so ordinarily, when it would execute this, it would do, there's some let statements here, and we construct this person data type. Well, I'm not bothering to compute the first name or last name. I just, do that later. I'm lazy. I'll do that later. Then here, get first name. Well, that probably just accesses the first field in this person, so it extracts the first name here. And it never touches the last name, so that wouldn't get evaluated ever. So it would be a very confusing program, because there's two getline calls, and it would read only once. So it's not really compatible with laziness. You would have to make some kind of rules that you first execute the first let, second let, and so on. So that's one problem. It doesn't fit with what we already have. Second is that Haskell allows substituting equals for equals. That's what we have been doing when we compute by hand. So for example, here. First name is equal to get line, and last name equals get line. Thus, first name equals last name. Right. Now I'm just replacing equals with equals. So this program, using what we have already learned during this class, would be the same as this program, which obviously doesn't do anything that we want it to do. And since Haskell doesn't really have, any rules on in which order, for example, let statements are computed, they are computed in the order that you actually use them in your program later on, it wouldn't really work. It's impossible to fit these effectful functions in Haskell, the same Haskell that we have now. Also these funny looping constructs. This is an interesting list. It starts with one, then it's a recurses back to ones. So it's, if you observe it, it's a list of 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 to infinite, or at least as long as you want to compute it. So it makes a fun way to, make this similar loops. Now, to get all lines, if get line was not, if it was function, we could write something like this. Then we could do the same thing. Get all lines, well, it would work by getting the first line from the user and then getting all the other lines. But how many lines would this actually read? This is a string. Nowhere does the type say that this is something that you actually execute, you read something from it. So it might be valid that it reads first line. It probably reads something like a cat. That's the string. Okay, get all lines is a cat appended to get all lines. So the thing that you have is cat, 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 and so on. No dogs. No, get line is probably only once. So it would get really hairy to have this kind of a behavior. And the language should be really different. And of course, this is a matter of choice. You can define set of rules in some imaginary language that would allow sensible behavior for all of these above examples. You just would choose that, okay, if it reads like this, then I store somewhere in the memory a bit that says that you have to evaluate the action every time and make all these nice rules about how things would work. You would probably lose laziness in the progress. Making a lazy language with functions like this is quite hard. It would be half lazy, half not lazy, and the rules would be very difficult to follow. Some optimizations, for example, some compilers, you know, if there's two expressions that are exactly the same, it computes them both at the same time, so it doesn't compute things twice. It eliminates common sub-expressions. It allows inlining stuff. So if you have this small definition here, and this big definition, it calls the small definition. Instead of making function calls all the time, it just copies the contents of the small function inside the bigger function, and then the compiled code doesn't have to jump around. It's faster. So substitutions, you can't really substitute equals for equals if the substitution would contain any I/O function inside. So that would be bad. And also reasoning and debugging would be, you know, much harder, because now Haskell has this nice property that if you want to know what some function returns with some input, just call it. And you know, after then you have no questions. You call foo with argument 1 and it returns you 32. It will always do this. Now if you allow effects in the mix, then calling a function once actually tells you nothing about the function. It might return any value depending on the phase of the moon or how much you have already typed, time of the day, whatever. And this is, sounds a bit, you know, academic, but you know, that happens. In big projects that you look, any big web page or whatever, you have some state, and even innocent looking calls end up doing, going to the database, modifying stuff inside the database, coming back, and you get situations where stuff, you know, behaves differently for different people. All these weird effects. So this is to tell you that it's just a Haskell choice that we have this I/O thing. You can make it differently. Okay, how does Haskell work? This is the simplified story, and I simplify quite a bit. So in Haskell, all the functions with access to real world are marked with I/O. For example, a read file, it consumes the file path, telling it what file to read, and it returns you I/O string. It's not a string that you can start using, it's an action that will, you know, when executed, give you the string. If you use the I/O stuff in your own function, then it also needs to be I/O. And when you use this I/O stuff, like read files, you have to explicitly say in which order, how many times, when is it executed, and you know, is this line executed before this line. You have to fix all of these. And finally, the last detail, you know, you build up this big, big, big I/O action, which is your program. It calls the pure parts of your code, and then you place it in the main function or main method or main procedure or what is it called. And that is the thing that gets executed when you compile your program and run the binary. So inside main function, you can do I/O and nowhere else. If you write I/O functions, there has to be something inside the main that calls something which calls your I/O function. There's no way to access them anywhere else than in other I/O functions or in main. Sounding complex. Well, not really. In practice, this is very easy. It's just, you know, you sequence your commands. There's nothing really hard about this. Usually people trip up with the fact that if you have an I/O action, you can't use it in your pure code. You can't turn I/O int into an int, for example. There's no way to do that. You have to have your main execute your action, and then you get the int. Also, if you mix pure functions with I/O, you have I/O. So that rules, that's the consumes the pureness factor, it makes it impure. And since the order of operations is important when doing I/O, I mean, that's the, you know, most essential part about if I have, say, my computer, you know, communicate with me, ask me questions, you know, it should first ask me the question and then start printing out the greeting. You know, it doesn't really work that it would imagine a new order of these operations. It couldn't talk to other computers, for example, because you know, no one knows in which order things happen. So we have this special notation for specifying, you know, order of actions in I/O. Okay, this is the bird's eye view. Any questions about this? No. If it does I/O, it gets marked I/O. That's the big deal. So, nature of I/O, what does it mean if I write I/O int, for example, or I/O string? It's nothing special, really. And it's a type constructor. We have seen type constructors before. Lists are type constructors, maybes are eithers. It's just the same thing. So I/O int is not that different from maybe int. You know, both are some types with, you know, the first parameter instantiated to int. Some same operations even work for both. You can say fmap plus one. That will work for I/O int and maybe int both. I/O is a functor. We discussed a little bit about functors last time. So you can fmap over I/O actions. Both work as arguments, can be stored in lists, you know, work nicely as a return values, arguments, whatever. So basically I/O int, just that's just a value. It's a value that, you know, represents some kind of a mini program that you can execute during the main invocation. And working with maybe int and I/O int, although it's similar, they of course have different operations. You know, maybe has from maybe, and I/O int has stuff like map m sequence, read line, get contents, and stuff like this. So, biggest thing, since IOA is just a value that you can pass around, you would eventually end up in a situation where you want to have something like this. You want to have a function from IOA into an A. And this tends to confuse people at the start. You can't have that because of the first few slides where I tried to show you all kinds of problems that would arise if you had a thing like this. The reason is that the IOA is an I/O action. It's not a container that has an A inside it. It's a bit like a function. Just like you can't extract the int from this kind of function. I mean, you have to call that function, it computes you the int, but you can't just pattern match it away from here. You can't extract the string from the I/O string. It's this mini program which gets executed by the main, and it can produce values then. You have to execute it before you can get the A. There's no A inside, it produces the A, or the string in this case. And the value is available inside the I/O, or inside the do blocks, which is the next topic. Okay, this is all a bit theoretical right now. We need a few examples to really grok what's going on. But any questions right now? Difficult to explain, in practice very simple. So I mentioned that the most important part about I/O is to make correct sequence. You first read the name of the user, then you greet the user, and then you say bye to the user. You have to fix the order of things that happen to be what you want. And this is do notation. Looks like this. And it makes things easy. It's really simple, you know, part of the language. It's like, you can think of it as a micro Java, for example. It basically has two blocks, first command, second command, third command, fourth command, and so on. It has few different parts. There are these, you know, plain actions that get just executed. These just, you know, print something. There are these, you know, statements that bind. So get line, It's executed and the result is bound to the first variable called first. And yeah, this is how you get the A out from IOA. In the do blocks, you can pull stuff out from the IO actions. Here you can pull out the result of the get line and give it a name. And now you have a variable called first, which is in scope for the rest of the computation. Really simple. Also you have these pure bindings, so you can give names to expressions and so on, but less important. So this is kind of a lot of smoke from a very little fire. There's nothing that is actually that difficult. If you look at this program, if you know Pascal or Java or something, you can probably instantly relate to what is happening here. It's a philosophy behind this that is complex part, not the practice. So what we have? We have three kinds of things that we can put in the do blocks. We can execute an action and bind the result to a variable. We can just execute an action in case it's like a print that doesn't return any reasonable value. And finally, we can give names to some expressions, which is usually convenient but hardly necessary for anything. And if you need something else like for loops or while loops or things like this, just use a recursion and you're done. So, very easy. The mindset behind this is that's the different part. You use it just like you would program in Java, no difference at all. But the philosophy behind it is different. The do blocks are actually expressions that produce I/O values. So do blocks, they make bigger I/O actions or more complex I/O actions from simpler building blocks. So this thing here that we had, this is one do block, and actually this part here, this is just a recipe for building a bigger, you know, I/O action. It's an I/O action that does some meaningful thing instead of being just, you know, the smallest possible part in your program. So this do returns I/O unit, and in main, when the program is executed, the do block or the I/O action there gets executed. Question, yes?
Yeah, it seems that you have a typo in like the slides once again, because here in the code that I have here on my slide, it says last I put string line, and then at the end it calls the second and not also. Did you change it just recently?
Yeah, you have to reload it. I changed it before the lecture. Should be the same though, unless you had the slides open in some time before. Shouldn't be many changes there. Okay. Any questions at this point? Simple thing with a complex philosophy. No, everyone is fine with this. Okay, let's test. So, implications. If I define an I/O action called F, that works by getting a line and returning the reverse of that line. What can I do with that? Can I put F in a list? Is this valid Haskell? Can I do this? Suppose then, can I give this F as a parameter to some other function, G, that might or might not use it? Is it possible to give an I/O action as an argument to a function, which returns some int? Okay, if that is possible, is it possible to make something that actually pulls out the string from the I/O action? Clear enough. Okay. And yeah, looks like about this. So this calls for a discussion. I think I'm quiet at this point and your friends can explain this to you. If you have any questions about the questions, ask. Otherwise, just, you know, spend few minutes discussing in groups why the answers are what they are. Try to convince your group that you are correct. Okay, and it seems rather clear at this point. So, metaphor for, you know, I/O actions. This is my classroom metaphor for an I/O action. It's this thing that has some instructions for me. And this is a thing that I can manipulate. I can put it in my pocket, for example. Or if I would have something that looks like a list, I could put these in a list. All right, that's an I/O action. Now, do block. That's basically, you know, gluing these two together. So you have sequence of commands. And suppose that, you know, you would be the main function, I would give you these, and then you would, you know, first wave and jump. That's the thing that we have. These answers, okay, first one, yes, yeah, I can put it in my pocket, I can put it in a list. Second one, probably the question was not altogether clear. You probably might have interpreted in two different ways with about 50-50 probability of the interpretations. First, I can't implement the G in a way that anyways touches this string. I can make, for example, you know, easy way to implement the G whatever equals 42. Yeah, I can implement it like this. I can, you know, I can't really do anything with the IO string, but I can still, you know, accept this as an argument. Makes more sense if I take a list of IO actions and, for example, calculate the length of the list. So yes and no, depending on how you understood the question. And finally, yeah, you can't actually get anything out from the IO because, you know, jump, what would jump produce? Sweat. Can't bring sweat from this piece of tissue paper. No, have to jump first. Yeah, so it's simple like that. Yeah, it's not a problem anyways. A second is a syntactical question. Let's do this next. Suppose I write something like this. Probably is not correct Haskell. Might be correct Haskell. Can I do this this line in specific? Is this something? Can I do that? Other way of thinking about this question is, what can I write on the right side of this arrow? What kind of an object should I have here? Is this kind of a list, is it okay? And 20 answers and we can probably discuss. Or if it is too obvious, then we don't. Okay, 20 answers, so yeah, good enough answer for, you know, just skipping the group part. It's not okay, because only thing that can be on the right side of the arrow, it's IO something, it's IO int, IO string. Nothing else will do in this context. In general, however, this do notation is applicable to other things than I/O. It doesn't really constrain us to use just I/O. We could use do with maybes and stuff like that. So if we, however, claim that this is some kind of an I/O action, this would fail because everything on the right should be I/O actions. And if you actually bother to, you know, type this whole thing in GHI, and leave out the type signature, you get a very strange program, because then the do notation applies to the list and not the IO action, which makes for hairy mistakes. So basically, what we learned, right side of the arrow, it always has to be IO something for it to work. Okay. Then, about types. Types are actually a brilliant tool to work with do notation and IO things because they tell us almost everything that there is to know about these. But we have to figure out how the types are assigned. So if I have this kind of a Whipple function, the underscore is a typo that, you know, we use here. Then we are, of course, interested in the x and the blob or the argument. And we, to be able to use this construct, we have to know the types. So what is the type of x inside this ellipsis here? After this line, you know, x is in scope, what is the type of x? And what is the type of the argument? And this is kind of a question that you could probably, if you had enough time, just, you know, figure out without even reading the course material at all. Okay, 23 answers, so I can probably check and see if we need to discuss about this. Okay. Yeah, we have two candidates for this. I think almost everyone agrees that no and no, but these two. Since these are type definitions, there's only one correct answer, obviously, because nothing can have two types at the same time. So the middle two, you can concentrate on those and convince your friends that your answer was the correct one.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have this kind of a distribution, probably not this, and likely this. So let's first check the argument, this type of the blob, because that's written there. It's the first argument to this function, and it's foo. So it can't be IO foo. Doesn't work, because IO foo doesn't fit in place of a foo, just like you can't put maybe int in place of an int. So this has to be just foo, leaving these two possibilities. Now, why would this one be a very bad choice? Suppose we had a different kind of a program. For example, this program would read an integer from the user and then calculate the, you know, product of that integer or its divisors, or do any kind of computation with that integer. For example, it would multiply x by 2. Now, would this first one work? Well, here, suppose we have simple types, and x would be IO int. Well, we can't multiply IO ints. And multiplication requires plain ints, and IO int doesn't work. So it's not this. The whole idea is that this describes this kind of a, you know, sequence of computations, like this one. And within this sequence of computations, we bind a new variable to a result of some action. And then we can use this variable in the remaining action. We can, for example, print it out to the user. So within this do block, x has the type var, or doesn't have IO in there. Okay, clear enough. If it would be IO something, we couldn't use it anywhere, and this would be totally useless. Okay, clear. Yeah, at least one person is nodding, so it's absolutely clear. So, in general, the do notation. What's the feeling? Can you work with it? Of course, there are minor details, and the library documentation is sometimes very bad. But in general, you know, do you feel confident? On the scale of very confident to I have no idea what I'm doing. Yeah, well, going there at least. It's honestly, this one is not complex. Then we have something that actually is complex, and which is also important when we are doing Haskell. Because, well, turns out that the do notation actually is syntactic sugar for these operators and not the other way around. It's easier to teach the other way around, but it's funny in this sense. So, operators, we have this bind operator, which has this very big type. And this is actually the second reason why IO is on the second to last lecture. Because I want to talk about these operators. If I discussed about IO in the first lecture, we would need to know what is a type constructor, and we would need to know what is a type parameter, and it wouldn't really work. And certainly if I pulled out type like this, I would lose all the students in the first two lectures. So we have to just, you know, postpone it to this point. So this is a nice function. It's you might be wondering, why do I need this kind of a function? I don't have to use it during this course. Yeah, pretty much you don't. But when you do Haskell in, you know, real context, this will pop up. And I don't want you to be overly confused at that point. So what does the type say? We have some kind of IO action A. We have this jump, which is IO sweat, I guess. And then we have a function that takes as an input whatever the first IO action produces. And it returns a different IO action, which basically describes the whole result of this computation. So what's the point of having a thing like this? It's implemented like this, or, well, do is actually implemented based on that, but we can imagine that this is the actual semantics. So we have x that is bound to f of y, or f y. And what does this code do? it first, well, it's going to be a do block. So it's going to generate an IO value. It's going to be this kind of a piece of paper with some IO actions inside. And first, it takes the left action, this IOA here, executes it, binds the result into a variable, and then feeds that variable to this function here, which results in IOB action. And then if this ends up as a part of your main function, the whole thing gets executed. And this is the same trick of pulling out values inside IO that we did with the do notation. The whole idea is that suppose this IOA on the top, it's say read file. It's going to read contents of a file. Then I need an IO action that prints the length of the file. But length function, it doesn't work on IO strings. It works on plain strings. So we have this kind of a trick. We take one IO action, then we take a function that tells us what to do with the result of the first IO action. And, you know, for example, we could have read file, and here we have a function that, you know, takes a string and prints out the length of the string. Very easy function to do. Then this operator binds these two together into one bigger IO action. And if that gets to the main, it gets executed. And basically, always you can convert this to this and vice versa. Similarly, we have this bind without naming things, which is basically sequencing actions. So first do the first action, then do the second action. Don't give a hoot about the result of the first action. Useful if you want to print many things, like do I have works like this. First do the leftmost part, then do the rightmost part. This is actually somewhat useful. In some cases, you don't want to write two lines on your do block. You can just write one line where you have all your prints or whatever in one block. It makes for a shorter program and possibly more understandable if you use it cautiously. So, based on this explanation, I want to build an IO action that reads an input from the user and, you know, echoes it back to him. So which operator do I use and how? And if the examples are funny, this was an exercise a few years back, and these are all picked up from the answers to that exercise. So which would work? Which would make any kind of a sense? Just purely thinking about the types. And to make this slightly easier, let me put the types on the screen. This might actually help you while you're answering. Let's make here are the types. Okay, 23 answers, and let's see if this this has been minimally confusing, I think. There's two choices. Well, This wouldn't work, obviously, because we throw out the result of the get line. So we can't actually bounce it back to the user. Then here, well, same thing. We would throw out the result of the get line, so it can't echo. But these two, just let's discuss. Only one of them is correct. Or is anyone brave enough in the of those people who voted this answer to tell me why this would be correct? Yeah.
Well, I think that put string is an argument.
Okay. Now, from this bar, the opposing opinion.
The whatever you call that, like, option there, it feeds the first argument, like, the result of the first action as an argument to the second one, and it's asking for the argument, but it kind of feeds it there automatically.
Yeah. Yeah, both good answers. Yes, it needs an argument. You are very correct in this. But this thing here, that automatically feeds the argument for it. So here, since this works like this, it pulls out the result of the X, and then whatever is the second thing, it feeds it there. So that's why you get this. Yeah, okay, this was, I guess, easy. Let's try something that is harder. This is just combining two actions, the previous one. That was easy. How about if we actually have to modify the thing in between? So we want to echo things back to the user, but we want to, you know, be all caps. Everything must be in uppercase. And all the information for this is, yet again, in the types. And this is the point of the point in the course where types actually start making things easier rather than harder. Okay, about 20 answers, so you have mostly, I think, figured out the answer by yourself. Okay, let's see. This initial distribution, yeah, this merits a small discussion with your mates. The first one, you don't have to discuss about this. That's wrong. Why is it wrong? Well, because this bind operator, make a mental replacement. Like I said, the bind and the do, they are more general. So we have this M of A, bit like functors. In this case, you can assume the M to be IO always. Doesn't really matter what it is if you're just using this, but we play with IO. So first operator is IO string. Yeah, it fits in place of this. M is IO and A is a string. Second one is function from string to IO B and map to upper. Well, that's not an IO thing. Doesn't work. And that's actually the way you figure out the rest. So in groups, wrong button. One person already answered for in this. So how about the rest? Ei, tässä on useampi oikein. Okay, the first two, these are still incorrect. This should be a function from string to IO. It is not. Second one, well, if this first one does not work, then how can the second one? Because this map to upper, even if we don't know the associativity of this bind operator, it's either like this or like this. In the first case, it's the exactly same as the first answer. Thus, if I put parentheses here, it wouldn't work because this should be a function to IO actions. If I put parentheses around the last part, well, then this has to be an IO action without any argument, just an IO action. And it's not an IO action. So that's wrong. Rest are all correct. And this is the basic progression which I suggest you to use if you work with these operators and stuff. First point, you could use this where statement or let bindings to make life easier for you if you have to use these. So an IO action bound to a function that, you know, somehow modifies the result of the first IO action and returns some other IO action. So this is an easy way to follow the types in your program. This is a function, that's the this thing here. That's the second part here. That's the second argument. It's a function from A to IOB, where A is, of course, a string, and IOB is probably the B's unit there. So that's easy to write. You know, you have a value, and you have a function, then you define the function. Then when you, you know, work with this notation for a while, you get bored to it, and it's, you know, too much to write, and you convert yourself into this form. You know, why not? Why not put, you know, a lambda function there? Why to give a name for this thing? Doesn't need a name because it's used only once. So this one works. Here's the IO action, and here is the function that manipulates the IO action. And then I guess this will result in this backslash key breaking in your computer because you use it too much. So you can start using the dot instead. Basically, this, you know, is exactly the same thing. Check out the definition of the dot operator. It tells you to do that. So, yeah. The last one is the preferred form. It's slightly bad in Haskell. In other languages, it's more natural because now you have to read in two directions at once. So get line goes this way, but the dot goes like this. So not so nice. For this reason, we have the reverse bind operator. So you have this, turn the characters around and you get something that reads in a nicer way. Just that if you want. Other languages have variants on the dot operator. You can make one as well if you like. So then we still have time. This is a really exhausting work, I think. There's this pattern of using do notation. We kind of saw it in the previous slide, but just to hammer the point through, we are making a IO action that, you know, sums two ints that it gets from the user, and we assume that we already have a function called readInt, which gets the ints from the user somehow. So how do I start? Which of these things should I write down first if I start working with this? Okay, that was very fast. 20 answers in record time, so I guess this will be easy. And surprise, it seems very easy. I guess we got the point home. So, well, the first one, well, I don't have to explain why that doesn't work anymore. But the final one, from this one, why does this not work? What's the... Okay. Yeah, yeah. You throw away the values of the reading, then you can't add anything together. Yeah, basically just like this. Okay, that's easy. That's very easy. Okay, next step. This slide. How do I proceed? Which is the reasonable thing to do? This also might be quite easy if you can read it. This is probably more an exercise of this, how to force yourself to read an equation with lots of symbols in it. That's the beef of this exercise. Okay, 20 and we can march onwards. So, yeah. So what was the beef of the question? Oh, again, here. Don't throw away the thing that you just read from the user. So you can approach this question by elimination. This can't work because the result of this read-int is thrown away. So it has to be the third one. Okay. No, seems easy enough. Let's check the full answers. Yeah, even better. But you probably did this by eliminating the unreasonable, leaving with the unlikely but only possible answer. Why does that work? So, how do you actually read this? Where do the parentheses go? That's the big difficulty in Haskell. Where do I put the bloody parentheses to make sense in things? So, where do they go? And here you are basically looking at the reason why we spend entire lecture in the early part of course just doing putting parentheses in place. Because it's really hard if you have to, you know, learn to read all these nasty operators I/O, and then you don't know how to, you know, parenthesize things. Okay, deluge of answers, 29, 32, and yeah, is this clear enough?
No,
not clear enough. just to check the mixture of answers in within groups. If you answered, let's say, green on the first, hands up. Come on, I'm not judging you. Just hands up if you answered green on the first. There should be 8 hands. Okay, 7 hands more. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out if all of you are in the same group. Because otherwise, discussing with each other is... Okay, let's do it like this. Discuss in groups, but change the groups so that, you know, if you if you are in the minority here, just go to a group that disagrees with you. Check around, you know, and if you can't find anyone to disagree with you, then just discuss with your old friends. But anyways, make the effort of finding someone who is who disagrees. You know, you can ask around. Okay, at least your answers suggest that this is clear. Okay, why is it not the first one? The rule for parsing lambda statements is that the lambda statement, you know, it's this dash, variable names, arrow, and then the body of the lambda statement it goes all the way till the end, until you have closing parentheses or something to stop it. Operators and others, they just belong inside the lambda. Of course, you can arrive at the same conclusion by elimination yet again. If you tell the compiler to, you know, compile this expression, it's going to say that, hey, in this place here, you have used the variable first, and it's not in scope, because obviously the first is in scope only inside these parentheses, inside this first lambda. So it's this. The important, crucial point, the second bind operator is inside the function that is argument for the first bind operator. Okay, do you want to see something rather awful or horrible? Yes, okay. There's always one who agrees with me, so I can do things like this. Okay, let's write a simple do block. Is this visible enough? Hopefully it is. So, okay, here is a simple I/O program for you. And how do I convert this into the operator form? This is completely mechanical. This is actually what happens in the compiler, pretty much like this, there's a few details. First, I'm going to throw away the do. Okay, fine. Then mechanically, I'm going to take this X and the arrow. And flip them around and move them back there. Here I have no, you know, nothing. So let's use this dollar operator here. That's basically adding the correct amount of parentheses. Probably isn't necessary even here. Antti Juhani will shout if I'm doing something wrong. Okay, here. Put string, it returns the unit type. So I make a lambda function there. Here, again, I just eat everything away and move it back here. This is again unit, and there, that's all. There you have it. That's the mechanical way of converting from do notation to the operators and basically back. I'm not actually sure, but I think when this thing was invented, the operators were invented first, and people wrote stuff like this, and then someone figured out it would be nice to write like this, and then you would make a do notation to make this easier. That would make it much more sensible. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for stopping me speaking complete bullshit the lecture. Okay, like this. That's a mechanical way. You put the bind there, and then you just put your lambda function there. If you, I don't know, probably the reason why we have the combining without binds is that this is boring to write. So people have done this. So it's completely mechanical, and it just flips around what you have. It's almost the same that you had before, but the other way around. And this way it's unreadable. The whole point, however, is the scopes of these lambdas. This X, this lambda here, enscopes all of these statements that come after it. So this lambda ends here. This lambda ends also here, a bit before the second one. So this is the mechanical, horrible way of writing Haskell. This is a surefire way to annoy your coworkers. Stop using do blocks and write like this. Works just as fine, but yeah. Okay, I guess we are pretty much done. There's one warning note that I have to pass on. Laziness and I/O don't use these together. And this comment should travel through a time machine few decades back the original designers of the Haskell language, because now we are stuck with this. Some smart guy thought that, you know, IO actions like read file should work lazily. For example, you tell Haskell to read a big file and it should read only as much as you actually consume. And you could make a nice echo program, just read all the contents and print it out. And the runtime would magically, you know, run a bit of the reading functions, and then run a bit of the writing functions, bit of the reading, bit of writing, magically interleaving these things together. And you can make really small and fancy, nice programs like this. Except if you make reasonable programs like this, find out what is the biggest file in your directory, get the directory contents, here is a function that reads the file and counts the length of the file, then sizes, you know, map the get size over, okay, this is a typo, should be ordinary map. Maps the get sizes over all the files, then prints out the number of files, and then, unless there were no files, prints the maximum size of the file. A really innocent function, right? And what would go wrong here, except this one typo, but if we fix that? Perfectly nice program, just, you know, go over each of the files individually, count the length of the files. No. We'll open too many files. If you have many, many files, these will just eat up all your file handles. It will crash saying that I can't open any more files if you have big, big directory. Because this read file, actually, it opens the file, but doesn't do anything because of the laziness. And this get size doesn't do anything because of the laziness. And here, when we, you know, compute the number of files and so on, this will open all the files before doing anything, and then start computing, you know, sizes, which is really bad because then it will open 10,000 files. So, yeah, lazy I/O, meaning all your Haskell Prelude I/O functions dealing with files and whatnot, should be avoided. Instead, you know, if you make a real Haskell program, you don't have to do this in my course, but if you actually write Haskell, use functions from data.bytestring or data.text to write and read files. This way, you don't get this magical interleaving, which basically interleaves your life with problems. So that's the warning sign. If you do real Haskell programs, use these. Otherwise, you will have horrible time. Next is arguably the hardest part of the course. This was about the second easiest. We discuss about fold and fold R functions, and bit about the dot and the dollar operators. If you start doing these fold exercises, and you start feeling desperate, and it can happen easily. These are rather abstract stuff. Then remember that these are just the basic recursion. Look at the recursion slides. It's the exact same thing. You just don't write the recursion yourself. And then there's nice diagrams in the lecture notes that will help you. At this point, I'm done. Any questions from you? Okay, see you tomorrow or latest at the next lecture.